Hello there, Rich.
Hi there.
Hi. You are Rich Lowry, the editor-in-chief, or is that the right title for National Review?
Just editor. Someday, perhaps, I'll ascend to the glorious title of in-chief, but
in-chief.
I do not have that yet.
And I, of course, am Anna Marie Cox. I'm the Washington correspondent for GQ magazine, not CQ, but GQ. I know you're having trouble hearing me, and a lot of people make that mistake, but we're the ones with the fashion and the skinny pants and not... Not so much the congressional, you know, aid scandals and whatnot. But speaking of congressional scandals, Rich, what do you think of make of this CESTAC?
They got the CESTAC-Romanoff affair. I don't know, is an affair a little less than a scandal? If it hasn't achieved scandal status, is it an affair?
Can we call it a to-do, perhaps?
I think a to-do would be even a little less than an affair.
Yeah.
Well, it's the CESTAC, the White House take on it is that it was an offer of a non-job, basically,
mm-hmm.
and the Romanoff was a non-offer of a job. But I think they're cutting it pretty thin here just because technically if these were explicitly offered in exchange for getting out of these races, it would be legally problematic. So that's why you've seen the White House delay. That's why you've seen it obfuscate. That's why you put out, I thought, basically a ridiculous memo from the White House counsel, Robert Bauer, all of 7 paragraphs that really left a lot of questions unanswered. And it was very careful. It didn't go out of the way to say he was never offered. It deliberately went out of its way to avoid saying that he was flat out that he was never offered a paying job, CESTAC. Everyone's kind of wondering why in that memo it says these efforts were made throughout June and July of 2009 to see whether he'd be interested in coming into the administration or taking some job rather than running. But then all we heard about from CESTAC is a half a minute phone call from Bill Clinton, which obviously is not a 2-month-long effort. So
I think we're not getting
the complete story.
I think we're getting a complete story. I'm not sure if we ever will. I have to say that I am not someone who's overly concerned about this. In the sense, I'm not overly concerned about it as a Obama problem, but rather as a political problem for most White Houses. They're already starting to see stories turn out about other White Houses that have done this. My favorite being the LBJ tape that the New York Times had on the front page this morning. But I answer me this, Rich. This is just how politics happens in Washington, right?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I kind of have mixed feelings about it because I don't think most people are very careful about it. And I think everyone would be, everyone would realize there's something wrong if you went to a candidate and said, look, this is a quid pro quo. You only get this job if you step aside. And if you step aside, we're going to give it to you. If you don't, we won't. No one would ever say that because every ethical advisor would say, no, do not be that explicit. So there are ways these are done through indirection, and maybe, you know, the White House stayed on the right side of that line, but I'm not sure we entirely know.
What do you think is problematic apart from the, I mean, I think this is, we can say that you said basically this is how politics happens in Washington. We can prove it or not approve it. But if they're on the right side of legal, and I assume that that's actually what every White House has done since the beginning of White Houses almost. I mean, mm-hmm. In the early days of the Republic, they basically just traded jobs around with each other almost. I mean, there were only so many founding fathers and so many jobs. But so people have always kind of like done favors for each other. That's how you get around. That's how what politics is. So if it is on the right side of the law, what's the concern?
Well, look, there's just the sheer political mechanics of a story like this, where the party out of power is going to make the biggest deal they can possible, and is going to do everything they can to try to get some outside investigator looking at it, because it's a huge drain of time and energy and all the rest of it.
Right.
So it's just typical scandal dynamic
in
that way.
And do you support that?
No, and I'm glad the independent counsel statute is gone, because the independent counsel statute was a mechanism where this thing already would have had an independent counsel, basically, or that process would already be underway. And 2 years from now, we could almost guarantee someone would be on trial for perjury.
Right.
I mean, that's just the way it always worked. So I'm glad that's gone. On the other hand, I do really want to know what happened. I mean, my ideal outcome would be a congressional hearing. But Nancy Pelosi, despite her broom that she was going to clean up, you know, the House, of course, has zero interest in investigating this.
Yeah, I actually would like to see. I would like to know what happened, just for the sake of knowing what happened, because I'm curious about that kind of thing, and also because I think that you would probably agree that this seems like. I mean, I don't want to use the word rookie mistake because I don't think the people involved, I mean, certainly Bill Clinton is no rookie, but it seems rather unsophisticated given what we know about this White House in other political sort of other political operations. It seems like with both of these cases, with Romanoff and with Sestak, they weren't even like trying very hard, it seems like, you know, just to create a very good job offer. The Sestak one in particular is kind of crazy, like this unpaid position that he wouldn't have been able to serve on anyway. I'm sort of curious at what the game of telephone was, you know, to have this turn out so ham-fistedly. I can mix metaphors wildly there. Ham-fisted telephone.
Yeah, it's very puzzling, because even if he could have taken that unpaid advisory position, if you're a congressman and you've already been a 2 or 3-star admiral, being on such a board would be a nuisance.
Yeah.
It would be no benefit whatsoever.
Right.
So either they just had zero good options to dangle in front of him, and Sestak exaggerated the whole thing. And I don't entirely discount that, because you know everyone who knows him well says he doesn't lack for self-regard,
right.
But he did say in that initial interview it was a high-ranking job.
Yeah.
And he played coy, you know, about whether he was offered the Secretary of the Navy, which helped create all the speculation that had to be something big.
Right.
So, as it's just to put it in the crudest terms, I think someone's lying or someone was shady.
I think that I think in this case, I mean, just knowing, I mean, Congress people in general tend to be, I mean, we're all resume patterns in one degree or another, but people who go into politics, this will make a really smooth transition. If you see where I'm going here, I think that Sestak probably exaggerated just a little bit because it was like a local radio show, right? I mean, maybe he did it just because it seemed like it would make a better story. We all do that kind of thing. And in this case, it just attracted all kinds of attention. And I do think there's more to the White House take. I don't think they're being completely straightforward with us either. But I'm not sure. I tend to suspect that they're smart enough. At least, God, I hope they're smart enough that they stayed on the right side of the law.
Well, the other aspect of this is you can just get Obama on the hypocrisy all day long.
Well,
because I believe it's such a fraudulent campaign. He never meant to follow through on all this new kind of politics stuff that was boob bait for the young and the impressionable. And you know, the first thing he does practically out of the box is hire Rahm Emanuel, who is a really smart, shrewd guy, but he's not naive and he's not about changing politics in that kind of process-oriented way. So you have this guy was elected on the basis of this poetry, and then the prose is in the White House, the way it operates is pretty crude and tough, and I mean, it tells us something that we're comparing him to LBJ, and
who is actually one of my favorite presidents, I will say. But
well, he's a fascinating guy, a very weird guy,
yes,
but very fascinating. But there's one blogger reproduced some of the transcripts from those phone conversations when that deal was going down, and the guy they're trying to get out of the race at one point says, I can't take this offer. Everyone will think it's a quid pro quo, and I just can't do that to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it does show that this is a shadowy area, and everyone's always realized you can't be explicit about it, and you have to be very careful.
Yeah, well, you can't be. Yes, that's true, and also you can't put it in writing. That's actually the thing that I was surprised by with the Jim Messina email, still existing even. That seems rather, again, clumsy, let's say. But let's go back to exaggerating. Let's talk about Mark Kirk in Illinois, who seems to just be piling up misstatements one after the other. What do you think's happening there?
Well, I'm surprised. I thought I don't know him well, but I thought he was a very kind of smart and shrewd guy. And I would make a distinction, and let me see whether you buy it or not, between him and Blumenthal in this respect. I think Kirk, it appears to be kind of routine political exaggeration of your record and what you've done. I think I got a sense from Blumenthal there was some weird kind of guilt dynamic going there. I sort of bought the, I don't know whether you saw the Henry Allen op-ed in the Washington Post about why guys in that era who didn't serve kind of feel compelled to say they did or exaggerate what they were doing. But the Kirk thing is bad. You know, first I was going to discount the first one about the intelligence guy of the year or whatever, but now they've piled up and you can be guaranteed that every single candidate in the right now is doing a thorough scrub of everything, you know, that's on their bios, on their websites.
Yeah, I think the Kirk thing, I think whenever you get into, I mean, I kind of buy the pop psychology about Blumenthal, and I think also with him, you had a case of him wanting to establish common ground, you know, with veterans of the same era.
Right.
And I think with Kirk, it is more like the CSTAC, thing. And it's just like routine political exaggeration, but routine political exaggeration about something that, you know, is pretty serious. And I think that, he has not yet sort of, you know, gotten out from under it. And I'm not sure he will.
Yeah. It's partly that politics attracts the type of people who are prone to exaggerate about themselves. But it's also just partly, as you're referring to earlier, human nature. We all do it. Whenever you tell a story, whether it's in front of a crowd or just for, you know, friends at dinner, there's always that temptation to make it a little better.
Yeah.
And once you've made it better once, then the next time you might make it a little better than that. You know, and before you know it, you're telling something that's really not quite true, and you're doing it over and over
again. You're doing it about something that, like, this cuts to a very, you know, the brand, the Republican brand, in a way that, and actually in a way that's going to be very hard for him to get out of, I think.
We'll see. I mean, the Democrat has a lot of problems there, too.
That's true. And also, to go back to what you're saying, before this all started with him, I actually had only heard good things about him from people on the Hill. He was talked about as being a real go-getter and someone who with a big future. So it'll be interesting to see if he does escape this.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, do you want to go to oil spill? That'll be an easy break.
We did not manage to find a good segue.
Sorry, oil spill. Oil spill in nature cannot be contained, and our conversation has a very clean break.
Nice try.
Thank you very much. I will go first, if you like. I think this is not Obama's Katrina by any stretch. I think that we don't know what it is yet. I think at some point we might start to think that if it does get worse, like, you know, Katrina was Bush's oil spill. I mean, I think the magnitude of this disaster is still unfolding, and the number of people involved in it are still unfolding, and what mistakes were made is still being, you know, discovered. So it's hard. I almost think it's glib. It's obviously glib to call it, even though Katrina was a disaster, I think it's really, really short-sighted to call it Obama's Katrina. There, said my piece.
Now, do you, I don't know what you were saying about Bush and Katrina at the time, but do you feel any twinge of sympathy more than you might have before for what the Bush people were going through with Katrina? Which, you know, I would argue is a bigger catastrophe, certainly a faster moving one, and a more unforgiving one, and one where the human consequences were much more.
Well, the human consequences were immediate and fast moving, but much as with Katrina, you know, these tragedies are still unfolding in terms of, like, what the damages it did to the cities and communities and the people who lived through it. And I'm just saying, like, on the scope of this disaster, we don't know what the scope of it is yet. So it's. But to go back to whether or not I have any sympathy for Bush, I really have a hard time producing sympathy beyond, you know, sort of a recognition of his basic humanity and how.
Well, that's nice. That's nice, Anna.
Well, I mean,
so compassionate.
Merciful. I'm sure that he felt really bad. But I just think that, you know, when Katrina was happening, the image that I kept flipping to, actually, I'm going to invoke LBJ again, which is that was it the Mississippi hurricane that happened during his presidency, or was it again?
I think that's right.
And he went down and handed out bottles of water. And that is showmanship, right? But it sent a very strong message about where he was on this and who he was. And so I kind of wanted that from Bush. And as far as wanting that from Obama, he is a very different kind of person. And I think not his personality is not very much like LBJ's. although his tactics, I guess, have proven to be a little bit. He is a rather cool character. I did not expect a lot of hugging and, you know, emoting from him. And also, it's really hard, I think, to the kinds of things that you can do after a hurricane in terms of, like, immediate help to people. They're very physical and tangible and fast moving, right? There's something you can do. You can get down on the ground and do something. And we're seeing now these horrible, in a horrible, horrible way, like that the oil spill is almost like an existential crisis. Like there is nothing that we can do that can be done. There's nothing that the president can do, really. There's nothing that any one person can do. So I think people have been a little unfair about his lack of, you know, firsthand involvement. But then again, you know, I think it's a lose-lose situation. If he had done firsthand involvement and it still wasn't working, would he own it even more? I don't know. What do you think he should be doing?
Well, let me react to a bunch of things. One, I don't get the whole line of overwhelmingly liberal criticism that he has to emote more about this.
Yeah, I don't get that either. That's just not who he is. So.
It's not who he is, and I think people really care more about results than, you know, foot stomping or red face statements or tearing up. Now, I do think kind of disaster response 101 in terms of the PR, as you mentioned the LBA instance, you do get down there and get your feet and your hands dirty, and it was
right.
a PR mistake for Bush to fly over New Orleans.
Yeah.
They did it for, I think, you know, reasonable reasons, but as a former governor told me at the time, you know, whenever there's a flood, whenever there's a tornado, you have to put on the work boots and go right there with the people who are dealing with it on the ground. But I think both Katrina and the spill, to me, just show the limits of government. There's only so much government can reasonably be expected to do to control catastrophes.
Right.
And this is, you know, the worst spill in U.S. history. Katrina was just an enormous hurricane hitting a city that is below sea level where the flood walls breached. And I was pretty hard on Bush at the time. I think the federal response should have been a little more rapid, and they certainly should have federalized the whole thing rather than showing such deference to the incompetent governor down there. But when a disaster like that strikes, things are going to go wrong. And when something like this happens with the oil spill, there are going to be limits to how much you can mitigate it. Now, I do kind of buy their Louisiana politicians, Bobby Jindal and David Vitter, who do say the feds have been kind of slow on the uptake and the containment response there in Louisiana, and especially have been slow approving these barrier islands they want to try to build. So I'm prepared to believe that, because I just think that's inherent. That kind of confusion and slowness is inherent to the way government works.
Right.
But the really devilish political problem for Obama is that he's taken responsibility for something he doesn't have control over, and it really goes to the inflated sense we all have of the modern president. When there's something going wrong anywhere in the country, the buck has to stop with him, and he has to do something to stop it. And he can't stop this spill, you know, 5,000 feet under the ocean. He's entirely a hostage to fortune. And there's an Economist poll that just came out the other day that showed, and there have been other polls, I think, showing similar results, that people, you know, he's down, I think 30% of people approve his response, 45% disapprove. And it's just a fast artifact of the fact that this thing is still going, which he can't help.
Right, he can't. And I think you're right, we do look to the modern president, whether it's a school shooting or an oil spill or anything, any tragedy, we look to the president for answers. And of course, the horror here is that to the degree to which the federal government can help in this kind of situation, it would have been in the regulations that existed before this tragedy started. I'm sure that you're aware, in Canada, they actually require those emergency wells, those backup wells that they're trying to drill right now that they may not have done till August. And I think that...
Oh, they require them to be drilled beforehand?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. No, I did not realize that.
Yes, because if there's something like this happened in the Arctic, it'd be even worse, imagine, if you can believe that. If something like this happened in the Arctic, where the Canadian oil is, they recognize how they seem to have actually thought about what would happen in the worst-case scenario, whereas it's not clear that happened with BP. And BP did, you know, there's documents showing BP lobbying the Canadian government to try and get rid of that containment well provision, which I doubt will happen now.
That's interesting. I was not aware of that. Yeah, I'm a supporter of drilling, but this obviously this whole mess raises the question, if something goes wrong, you can't stop it, should you be drilling at that depth?
Or should you require the backup plan for the worst case scenario? And rather, that it sort of seems like they went into this just assuming that it wouldn't happen, or assuming that they could fix it. I'm really curious what will happen. I'm going to take a guess that you're probably not for the criminal investigation of BP.
Well, I'm learning more about that. I guess I heard someone saying the other day, basically, if you soil one bird, it's a violation, potentially, of the Migratory Bird Act.
Oh, wow.
So maybe there's grounds for it, but it certainly it dovetailed perfectly with the kind of ramping up of the shame and blame campaign against BP. And I don't get me started on Eric Holder. I just think he's totally house trained and there's zero chance that he'll look into the Sestak Romanov stuff, but when it served the administration's political purposes to go after BP, he's right there, right on time.
Well, I think it's probably, there's definitely a case to be made as far as, like, harm done to the world and to individuals, definitely more harm out of coming out of the BP situation than about the Sestak or, Romanov thing. Like, those are fairly victimless crimes, I think, if there was a crime in committed. Unless, of course, you consider, democracy and the idea of democracy functioning smoothly to be a victim in that case.
By that standard, almost any instance of public corruption, not any instance, but a lot of instances would be victimless crimes if you're just trading,
harm.
Public jobs
for
political favors.
Well, we've gotten to the end of our list. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
This would be an unduly brief Blogging Heads, wouldn't it?
I know. I feel like we should maybe just talk about television or something.
What else? Oh, you didn't follow the whole Perfect Game.
I did. Now I want to declare a moratorium on people writing op-eds about how that's where you shall behave, because I've seen five of them. And I understand
it was heartening.
It was heartening. It was a great story. It's a wonderful thing to see in this day and age, to see sportsmanship like that. And to see that it can be carried out on the team level, even to have the entire sort of community be cool. I also think it's somewhat poetic. I have to say, I'm my husband's the baseball fan, not me, but I do think it's only in baseball do you kind of get that sort of situation, the beautiful irony of that not perfect game.
I guess so. That's why it's produced the best sports writing historically. But I felt vindicated because I have long been an advocate of instant replay. In baseball, I would also have this balls and strikes called by lasers, and I would ban all the unnecessary delays when they stand around scratching, spitting, and having meetings on the mound. So I'm a baseball reformer. I think to bring out the best in baseball and preserve what's best, you have to change with the times. This is what a true Burkean conservative, the attitude he brings to something. So I just don't – everyone sort of says, baseball, it's imperfect, and that's part of the beauty of it. But there'll still be plenty of imperfection on the part of the players and the teams, even if you take measures to actually get the umpiring a little better.
Wow, a Burkean conservative take on reforming baseball. I'm going to have to tell – I'm definitely going to tell my husband about that. And I'm going to tell you right now that I'd be very against lasers calling balls and strikes.
Why? What's the problem with a lot of people just have this visceral negative reaction.
But it does do one thing, which is that I have a theory about the Venn diagram, which has political, aficionados, baseball fans, indie rock, and science fiction fans. There's a lot of overlap in that Venn diagram. And so I think you get the science fiction fans who love baseball would definitely go for the lasers.
Interesting. So is there a lot of overlap, do you think, in your Venn diagram between science fiction fans and baseball? Because that hasn't been in my anecdotal
experience. There is some. It's not a huge – it's not as significant, I think, actually. But what is interesting to me is the science fiction in politics, which I find all the time in Washington. And I think it has to do with believing in a rule-based world, where you can sort of set parameters and things, if you plan everything perfectly, it will go according to plan. And also, these are pursuits that are can be fun to do by yourself. And I think a lot of us that go into politics, either covering it or being in it, perhaps have a solitary side to ourselves.
Interesting. Are you a science fiction person?
I am a science fiction person. I'm actually right now reading a book that there's been some conservative libertarian kind of and conservative fan writing about. It's called Freedom TM, and it is about really, it's a sequel to a book called Damon, and it's basically about the contest for, of the, you know, the soul of America between corporations and a sort of living entity online that allows people to kind of be more libertarian, you know, like people setting up, you know, communities that are completely independent, off the grid, and whatnot. It's good.
Interesting.
It is good.
Well, there's definitely a big science fiction overlap with libertarians, and we see it on our site. Science fiction references in Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica and all the rest of it always generate a lot of interest.
But you'd be surprised. I mean, I think that they're for the liberals too. I will have to go and look for it, but I'm actually going to do that right now because I think we have now reached the end of our allotted, like, however much time we're supposed to have help people waste. By watching Blogging Heads.
All right.
I think we can do it now.
All right, Anna.
It was good to talk to you, Rich.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.